All righty, thank you very much. Well, welcome to Talk 2 in the James Mickens Seminar Series. I, of course, am your host, James Mickens. Let's get started. So now I'm going to talk to you about Mugshot, which is a tool for recording and replaying the execution of JavaScript-based browser programs. So modern websites have all kinds of advanced functionality in them, and typically this is driven by event-driven JavaScript, blah, blah, blah. I learned this to you already in my prior talk. I'm sure you believe me by now. So suffice it to say that web pages are complex JavaScript applications. And so, like all complex applications, they have bugs. And these bugs might manifest themselves in several ways. So, for example, you might get hard errors. Like there's an unexpected JavaScript exception that gets thrown. Or maybe there's a missing resource that it tries to download but can't find. There might also be soft errors, a layout glitch. Maybe there's a broken event handler. You click on something and something should happen, but it doesn't happen. Maybe you just have poor performance. But long story short, all of these things make the user angry and Hulk out. We want to prevent that from happening because we love our users. So what do developers typically do when something goes wrong? Well, there are a lot of very common postmortems, core dumps, stack traces, error logs, all that kind of stuff. Now, the problem with these approaches in our particular environment is that in event-driven systems like JavaScript applications, the interleavings of the events are key. We don't just want a static snapshot of the system at failure time. Really, what we want is a stairway to failure. We actually want the content and the ordering of the events that led up to the problem. Okay, so those interleavings are key. And furthermore, we don't want to rely on bug reports that beta testers use generate. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, the user might say, okay, I did X, Y, and Z, but maybe they forgot they did A, B, and C. People's memories are fallible. And second of all, even if they could remember everything they did, they can't actually see some things. They can't see the return value of the random number generator. They can't see the interleavings of AJAX events with respect to mouse clicks and things like that. So to solve this problem, we introduced a new tool that we call Mugshot. And essentially, it's going to log all the non-determinism in the JavaScript engine. Right? Mouse clicks, requests for the date, random number generation, and some other stuff I'll show you later. So the basic idea is that when you use a web page and something goes wrong, you panic, you upload that log to developer machine. The developer takes that log and then replays that actual buggy execution run from the wild on his or her local machine, leveraging the rich JavaScript debuggers that already ship in stock IE and stock Firefox, for example. So we think that Mugshot's awesome for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's easy to deploy to the end users. The logging and replay code is just JavaScript, right? So it runs in regular unmodified browsers. You don't need a special kernel or VM or anything like that. Second of all, the logging is pretty lightweight, and it's so lightweight, we argue you can actually run it in the common case. As I'll show you later in the evaluation, the log growth in worst case is 16 kilobits per second, and the CPU reduction with Mugshot logging enabled is worst case 7% reduction for a very high event rate game. And finally, we think that Mugshot solves an important practical problem because, as you know, many very important software components that used to be desktop only are now moving towards a very web-heavy presence. So here's an outline for the rest of the talk, pretty straightforward. I'll go through the nitty-gritty of how we log stuff. After I describe that, understanding how we replay things will be much, much simpler. And I'll give you some evaluation slides before concluding. So here's the example that we're going to use throughout the rest of this talk. We have three garishly colored frames here, a single parent frame, and then two child frames. Each one of them has a button you can click on, and presumably something amazing happens. So here's what the browser does when it parses a Mugshot-enabled web page. So the first thing it's going to do is it's going to find the logger.js. That's our logging infrastructure. Now that script is going to do two things. It has to run first, and that script's going to do two things. First of all, it's going to interpose on all the sources of non-determinism, as I'll show you later in the talk. And second of all, it's going to create an initially empty event log. So the browser continues to parse the HTML. Nothing exciting here. Aha. Now it's going to hit the source for one of those frames. And so you'll note that each individual frame has to have its own copy of our JavaScript library. And that's because, essentially, with respect to JavaScript events, each frame is its own little universe. So once again, that second copy of logger.js will instrument all the sources of non-determinism in that frame. And then it's going to point its log pointer to the one established by the root window. So for a multi-frame application, there's only one log, and that is maintained by the parent. And child frames sort of bucket brigade their events up there. So the browser is going to parse the second iframe HTML. It's going to do the same exact thing as it did with the first. And then you're ready to rock. Now, before I tell you how we actually log stuff, let me go over the official W3C model for handling GUI events. And this will be very important later on, as you'll see. So here I show you the visual depiction of the iframe on the right and then the HTML on the left. So let's say that you click on that button. So in the first phase of event propagation, this is called the capturing phase. And this is when the event essentially starts at the top of the HTML hierarchy and winds its way down to the HTML event that the HTML object that actually generated the event, which in this case is the button. So at this point, if the iframe had defined a capturing level handler, it could do something to the event before it gets passed down the hierarchy. In this case, it doesn't define one of those. So the second phase is the target phase. That makes sense. The thing that actually generated the event, in this case the button, gets to run its event handler. In this very simple case, we're just going to pop up a box, which is going to show the current date. And finally, you have the bubbling phase, where essentially you go up the reverse capturing path. And so once again, if the iframe had preferred, it could have defined a bubbling level handler, which could have run some code before the event's finally discarded by the browser. So we have our silly little application here. It's all mugshotted up. So what happens when you click on this button here? Once again, here's the event handler, and you'll note that there are going to be two sources of non-determinism that we need to log. First of all, we need to log the mouse click. You know, which button did you use to click on the thing? What was the DOM node target for the click? Second of all, we log the return value of date. So here's how we log events on Firefox. And as you might tell, when I say on Firefox, there are going to be some browser incompatibilities here that essentially have added 15 years to not my life, but my death date, essentially. It drove me crazy. So logging the date is actually fairly straightforward, okay? You do the expected thing. You wrap the underlying date in a logging wrapper that's going to call the underlying version, write it to the log, and then hand it back to the application. That's extremely straightforward. Now, logging the mouse click is also straightforward. These are clearly derision quotes if you know anything about me. So at a high level, here's what you want to do. At a high level, you want to put a capturing level handler on that iframe, okay? So here's what that's going to let you do. So you click on the button. Now, in the capturing phase, the event's going to be handed to the iframe. We run our mugshot handler. It's going to enter. It's going to create a new entry in the log for the mouse click. Then that event goes down to the target phase, right? We're going to execute the event handler. It's going to call date, but we've wrapped date, so we're going to log that. So everything's pretty hunky-dory. So I put derision quotes around it before. You might be saying, James, you have a penchant for exaggeration. Isn't this pretty easy? Well, guess what? That's a trap, okay? Because web browsers are the world's worst programming environment. They will screw you over every time and laugh about it with their friends. So let me give you just one of countless examples of why this is the case. Okay, so now we're going to have to get down a little bit into the code. So the problem that's hurting us here is the difference between DOM 0 handlers and DOM 2 handlers. So let me look at this very simple code example to show you what I mean. So in this code line here, we just get a JavaScript reference to an object representing the iframe. Here we define a DOM 0 handler. So we want to have something happen when the user clicks on something, so we simply assign to the special onClick property. The DOM 0 model is very simple. For each event name, there's a property, you assign it to it, you assign a function to it, you define an event handler. Now, obviously the problem with the DOM 0 model is you can only have one event handler for every DOM node event name pair. So the standards people decide to add what they call DOM 2 handlers, whereby you call this method called addEventListener to the DOM node. You can essentially add an arbitrary number of DOM 2 handlers. So the take-home point here is for any DOM node event pair, you can have at most one DOM 0 handler and an arbitrary number of DOM 2 handlers. So the thing we have to keep in mind is that Firefox calls the DOM 0 handler for any node before any of its DOM 2 handlers. And the DOM 2 handlers are called in order of the registration. Now, this actually makes life difficult for Mugshot. And the reason is that Mugshot has to make sure that its logging handler runs before any other application-defined handler does. And the reason is that application-defined handlers can actually cancel events, prevent them from propagating, essentially take them out of the event flow. We still need to log those events because we know they cause at least one function to execute, namely the application handler that canceled them. So here's what we'd like to do. Right? What we like to do is we run before the app as before. That's not hard. Just make sure our script tag's included first. And we want to define a DOM 2 mugshot logging handler for, let's say, onClick. And we also want to use the JavaScript setters to interpose in the assignment to iframe.onClick. So essentially, setter code is code that sits in between assignments, reads or writes to a particular property name. And they allow you to do things like, rejigger what's read or what's written before controls hand it back to the application. So we'd like to do this because what this would allow us to do is our DOM2 logging function would run first because we registered it first if there are no application-defined DOM0 handlers. That's exactly what we want. We run before the application can cancel it. Now, if the application has defined a DOM0 handler, our setter shim would allow us to wrap that handler in logging code before actually assigning it to the DOM node. That's what we like to do. Unfortunately, we live in the worst of all possible worlds. And in this case, this doesn't work because Firefox setters are actually, they're partially broken. So if you try to put one of these setter shims on a DOM 0 event name property, then when you actually generate an event for that property, the browser will not invoke the handler. Okay, and that's just straight up broken. I mean, that's just, there's no other way to look at that. So luckily, I have a deviant imagination. So you can actually get around this. So luckily, if you shim on these DOM 0 handler properties, they don't keep the browser from actually invoking DOM 2 handlers when an event's generated for them. So what we can do in our setter shim is actually we get that DOM 0 handler from the application, then we register a shadow copy of it, if you will, as a DOM 2 handler. Right? And then we also have to do some bookkeeping such that if the application changes the DOM 0 handler, we deregister our shadow DOM 2 version of it. So you're probably looking at me and saying that's a big mess, and guess what, you'd be right. But as anyone who's done any web programming knows, this is just what you have to do. Look at anything like jQuery, MooTools, they do all these kinds of tricks. So, you know, I hate myself, but this is life. So, just to recap, here's how we log events on Firefox. We have that iframe capturing level handler for the click, and then we wrap the date and login code. Okay, and as I just went through, there's some strategy you have to do to make sure that our iframe level handler gets called first. Okay, so that's how we do things on Firefox. Ah, yes, now we come to my good friend IE. So, on IE, logging the date is straightforward. All you do is the same wrapping technique that you used before. Now, logging GUI events is tricky on IE. Now, why is that? Now, wait for it. Oh, no, there is no capture phase on IE. Who did this to us? So, yep. So there's no capture phase. Now, you might be thinking, once again, Jimmy Mickens, you are the victim of unchecked hysteria. Why can't we just go through here and just add a bubbling level handler for the event, right? So now when you click on something, first we're going to log the date, right? Then it's going to bubble up, then it's going to get to the iframe, and then we'll just log the click, right? That seems to solve the problem. There's a lot of problems with that solution. But one of them is the fact that we kind of have a chicken and egg problem now. Because note that the entry of the things in the log is actually causally reversed, right? It was the click that actually caused the date to take place. But in our log, we have those two things reversed, okay? So you can actually fix this. And so you fix it as follows. So let's imagine we click on the button again, and we log the date. But inside our date wrapper, we actually have code that says, is there an unlogged outstanding GUI event? And the reason that we can do that is because there's this global IE variable, window.event. You can always just check. If it's null, there is no outstanding event. If it's set to something, yeah, that's the currently being handled event. And so we say, ah, yes, there is something there. And so what we do in the date wrapper is actually reverse things at that time, right? So now the log is properly ordered. The timestamps are going to be a bit off, but the causal ordering is the most important thing. And then when that thing, the mouse event, bubbles up to the bubbling phase, then we say, oh, we've already actually logged this event. Don't double log it. We essentially put a little flag in the event. So there's all kinds of different sources of non-determinism in the browser. You can look in the paper to see what all these things are. I'll just give you one more example of things that we have to log. So set timeout F, 50. The semantics of this are you're telling the browser, in 50 milliseconds, I want you to invoke this callback F. Okay. So how do we log this? At a high level, once again, it's quite easy. So you do a couple things. First of all, you're going to get a reference to the original underlying set timeout. Then you're going to redefine a wrapped version, which is going to do three things. First, it's going to take any user-specified handle. It's going to assign a callback ID to it, a little integer, basically. This will allow us at replay time to figure out which handler we have to dispatch. And then you're going to actually wrap the user-specified callback in login code so that when it is actually called by the browser, we can say, ah, it was called at this time. And then finally, we're going to call that old set timeout, right, to actually register this wrapped callback with the browser so it is actually invoked in 50 milliseconds. So as you know here, easy, right, I'm clearly tricking you. This doesn't work. It's a disaster of epic proportions. There's dinosaurs eating buildings. So here's the reason why this doesn't work, and this is actually pretty insane. So here's what we're trying to do. Note that when we try to save the reference to set timeout, the browser garbage collects this reference. Note that we've saved a reference to it. This is anti-garbage collection. This should never happen, but it happens on both Firefox and IE. I'm an old man inside. I'm already dead. So what this means is that when we actually try to call old set timeout inside of here, it's going to fail. You'll get like a JavaScript error that says undefined function. This is just so bad. So in this slide, which I delightfully title, I Hate Myself and I Want to Die, I describe how you yourself can solve this problem. So what you do is you create an invisible iframe. This is sort of like a standard web browsing hack. When something goes wrong, create an invisible iframe. So essentially what you do is you create the iframe and you save a reference to its set timeout function. Okay, and then you can actually call that inside of the wrapped callback. And we have to do this nonsense at replay time too. We have to do a bunch of other hacks like this. See the paper for details. I'm just crying just silently, even just describing it to you. So let me just briefly tell you how we log loads. Okay, and we do this in the standard way. The concern here is that the binding between a URL and a set of bits may change in between log time and replay time. So for example, a.jpg may mean different things at log time versus replay time. So to make sure that we return the right set of bits at replay time, we simply stick a proxy, a transparent proxy, in between the user's browser and the web server. So what that proxy can do is on the way out to the client, it can instrument the HTML with our logging infrastructure, and you know, as it's delivering images and JavaScript and all that kind of stuff, it saves that stuff to replay cache for use later. So that's logging. Now let's briefly look at the replay aspect of things. So here's the proxy again. So at replay time, you actually use that proxy as your web browser. Or sorry, as your web server, excuse me. And so you get all of your data from there. It can look in the log and say, ah, these are the sets of bits that I returned to you at logging time. And if it sends any HTML back to you, it can change the logger code to the replay code. Now, here's what you see on the developer machine, right? So the developer sets his web proxy to be that replay proxy, goes to the same URL you went to. Right now, here's what our replay infrastructure is going to do. So first of all, it's going to put a transparent iframe on top of the page. The reason for that is you don't want the developer to send actual GUI input to the page that will cause the replay to diverge from what you saw at log time, okay? The second thing you want to do is interpose on date, math.random, set timeout, all that kind of stuff that I showed you before, except now we're actually pulling stuff from the log as opposed to logging stuff and letting it do its natural thing. The next thing we're going to do is fetch the log from the replay proxy, and then we're going to display a VCR-like control. This essentially allows you to single step through the JavaScript events. You can play them in quasi-real time. There's a little menu at the bottom that shows you the details of the most currently dispatching event. That's pretty straightforward. And then you hit play, and the expected stuff happens. So if you find a fake GUI event, if you find a GUI event in the log, you dispatch a fake one at replay time using some infrastructure that browsers already ship with by default. As you encounter timer callbacks in the log, you just execute them as you find them, right? At replay time, you don't want to actually register them with the browser because you know when they're supposed to be executed. As the code executes, it's going to make calls to date, to math.random. You just pull those things out of the log. And then when load arrives, you can signal the replay proxy so they can actually give you the load at replay time at the same time that it gave it at logging time. So now let me give you a couple slides of evaluation, then I'll conclude. So there's two questions we want to answer. First of all, how big do mugshots logs get? Right? And second of all, what's the overhead, primarily in terms of CPU? So here we show log growth for a bunch of different applications on Firefox. The trends are the same on IE. And the first three applications are games in increasing order of frame rates. So Tetris, Pac-Man, if you don't know that, then I'm not sure you're a computer scientist. Spacious is a 2D kind of like Galaga-style shooter, right? It's actually got the highest frame rate of all of those. And know that the animations are implemented in terms of timer callbacks, which will be important for the next experiment. So typically, each time space ghost moves or whatever, that's a timer callback firing and updating some piece of the screen. The fourth application is some fool wrote a basic interpreter in JavaScript. And then we have a painting application, very simple. And then what you see is what you get, editor, JavaScript shell, blah, blah, blah. The main take-home point here is that if you look at our compact log format, which is what you'd actually use in practice, this is LZW compressed and it's machine packed and all this kind of stuff, you'll see that in the worst case, your log is going to grow at approximately 17 kilobits per second. Right? The reason it's so bad in Painter is because you actually have to track mouse movements, right? Because as you make your drawing, you're moving the mouse a lot. And so many applications don't care about this, and we turn that logging off if you like. But in Painter, we have to track that, so that makes the log a little bit bigger. So 17 kilobits per second, we think, is quite reasonable. Now, here we're going to look at the CPU overhead, and the metric we're going to use to measure that is the rate at which an application can fire timer callbacks. So like I said, here we're looking at Spacious, which is this high frame rate 2D shooter game. And as I said, all animations are implemented in terms of a callback firing. So if Mugshot has too much CPU overhead, We're going to be able to fire fewer callbacks per second, and this is going to make the frame rate lag, and people are going to get angry and turn into the Hulk that I showed you at the beginning of the talk. So what we show here are the number of callbacks issued in the baseline case. We're not doing any logging or replay. Then I show you how many callbacks are fired with our logging infrastructure in there or with our replay infrastructure in there. So the most important thing is that the number of callbacks fired in the logging case is as close as possible as what would be fired in the normal case. And that's because we're willing to waste a little bit of developer time on the replay side, but at logging time, if the user perceives a difference, they're going to say, you know, screw this, I don't want to run with your mugshot-enabled application. And so what we see is that on Firefox, the reduction in callback rates is about 2%. On IE, it's a little bit worse, so it's around 7%, but, you know, this is a research prototype, et cetera, et cetera. We can actually improve that, we think. Now, at replay time, the performance difference is actually much bigger, so 3 to 4 times. And we've actually improved this since this slide was made. But the way that the improvement came about, we were doing some synchronous string operations and parsing the log, and that was in the critical path of the fake event dispatch cycle at replay time. So we removed that, put that in the beginning, like a pre-processing step. So these numbers are actually much better. But that notwithstanding, these are still fine, we think, for replay time. Because if you can get the developer a bug that's from the wild and they have to take, you know, 2 times to replay it back, they're typically fine. So in conclusion, failure is everywhere. And these web pages are just getting more and more buggy, and it's a problem. For those of you who are adventurous, you can surf the web and actually leave your JavaScript error console on. You will be horrified, right? They're getting thrown all the time. Objects aren't existing. It's just a big mess out there. You had to grow up sometime. Sorry that I'm the messenger, but don't kill me. So there's a lot of problems out there. And we don't want to rely on these standard postmortems like stack trace and stuff like that because we want these event interleavings. And so what we did to attack this problem is introduce a new tool called Mugshot, which is a tracing and replay system for JavaScript applications. So it's easy to deploy because, once again, you're just running a regular JavaScript library inside an unmodified browser. So much like the Chrome project, we took advantage of the fact that JavaScript is a very introspective language. We can do all kinds of sort of neat self-modifying things to applications. And as I showed you in the evaluation, the overhead, we think, is actually quite acceptable. So in the worst case, for a high event rate game, there's 7% CPU overhead. And for the worst case, for a painting application where you're just constantly generating GUI events as you're drawing stuff, you see 16 kilobits per second of log growth. And note that in the case of things like, let's say, CNN, MSN, I mean, the log is going to be trivial because most of the time you're just clicking on something to think time, clicking on something else, think time. So we think these numbers are quite good. And so another take-home point for this is that the design for Mugshot was actually quite straightforward at the high level, right? But as I showed you, there's a lot of implementation details that are actually quite tricky to get right. And so this has sort of, you know, made us think about, you know, what's a better way to architect browsers, and we can maybe talk about that sort of offline later. But, you know, take my learnings and make them your own, and then hopefully when you go out there and you produce a Mugshot running in multiple tabs, you won't encounter some of the problems that I had. So with that, I will conclude, and I'll be glad to take questions.
Hi, Rodrigo Fonseca from Brown.
Howdy.
So, howdy.
Howdy back.
So just like in the previous talk, there was a question similar to this. Applications are running half in the browser, half in the server. Do you see any way of integrating this replay with stuff that happens in the server as well?
Right. So one thing I didn't go into too much here is that we log things, for example, like HTTP headers. We log the return value of AJAX requests and things like that. So, you know, if your interaction with the outside world is mediated through things like AJAX requests, then we do actually handle that. You know, we log cookies and all that type of stuff. So in many cases, we can handle that.
Chip Killian, Purdue. Quick question. I don't want to add any more years to your life, but how much work would it be to make this work for, say, Opera and Safari?
Security, take this man out of here, please. No. So that's a good question. So here is my intuition about that. Essentially, there are two types of browsers out there, those that are relatively DOM compliant and then those that aren't. Now, Firefox is relatively DOM compliant, as are some of these other browsers like Opera or Safari, things like that. So I believe that a lot of the work that we did to port Mugshot to Firefox, you could actually reuse a lot of that code. IE is kind of like a special case because it has some weird events that other browsers don't have, and it partially supports some things and then adds totally new things in other cases. So my intuition is that, you know, if we just started with Firefox and we wanted to port to Safari or Conquer or whatever, that'd be fairly straightforward. But the leap from Firefox to IE is actually quite large.
How necessary is the proxy server model to the replay proxy thing? Can you package all this up as just JavaScript that you hand out to people?
So if I understood your question correctly, do we need the proxy at all? I mean, could we be clever and actually put all of its functionality into the client-side JavaScript?
Yeah.
Okay, that's an excellent question. The answer is no. We do need the proxy in many cases. And the reason is that, well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, JavaScript code cannot directly inspect the cache, right? So one thing that we're worried about is maintaining the log time binding between a URL and a set of bits and then having that take place at replay time, right? So there would be no way for mugshot JavaScript to, after an image fetch, look in the cache and somehow, you know, encode that in the log. So if you're concerned about that binding mutating, then you have to use the replay proxy. Now, let's assume that you used immutable names, right? So the name a.jpg would always refer to the certain set of bits. The other thing that you can't control in pure client-side JavaScript is the ordering of loads. And that was something that we thought about for a long time, and that, I mean, as far as I know, it can't be done. So basically, if, you know, let's say you issue two fetches for an image, you know, one of them is going to come back first. It's very difficult in the general case to order those on the client side. And that's another reason why the replay proxy is useful, because it can look in the log and say, okay, this thing's supposed to load first. I'm going to give you that last bit before I start giving you, you know, the next bit of that thing that should have loaded second.
Any more questions? So is the conclusion just stick with research on JavaScript transformations for fun and profit, or are you ready to move on with life?
I'm going to become a painter and work with children.
Nice. Okay, let's thank Jim.